Hello, curiously chaotic humans. Welcome to our show. Welcome back to episode 4 of this series. Today we have a special guest here who is very, very curious about space, life on other planets, and also interstellar travel. This is going to be a fun episode for you guys. So please welcome Dhananjay, who will be talking about space colonization. Let's welcome Dhananjay.
Yeah. Hi, Shanky. It's good to be on the podcast. When you told me about today's topic, I was screaming like a little girl because this has been one of my favorite topics for a long time. I mean, I have been reading anything remotely related to space since I was 10. So, yeah. Wow. This is something I can talk about for hours. So over to you, Shanky. We can start.
Great to hear that. So space colonization is a really, really good topic. Like, I have seen the movie Martian on your recommendation. Also read the book. The book is much better. So it shows really like a true values of how you can live on a different planet altogether, grow your own food, have a peaceful living in a way. I also did some research, and a lot of bloggers actually said, and a lot of scientists actually said that Martian was very accurate movie. Believe that. But apart
from just one thing, which was that Martian storms aren't that heavy.
Powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. The pressure, the air pressure on Mars is probably 1 or 2% of that on Earth. So it's nothing. So you wouldn't even feel the breeze. Like a hurricane on Mars, if you were just standing on the surface of the Mars without a spacesuit, and if you could breathe through all the near vacuum, you wouldn't even feel it on your face. It's that insignificant. Yeah. So apart from that one major flaw, everything I think was accurate.
Like, I also read that too. The most funny thing I still found now is like making potatoes from your own poop. I would not eat that, but I'm pretty much curious enough to try it once.
People have been doing that since the medieval ages. If I'm not wrong, in the Europe, I think it's called something like night soil.
Okay.
Farmers in the medieval Europe used to use their own poop, which they collected in buckets, and then they used to mix it with soil, and then they used to use that for growing their crops when fertilizers or, you know, in times of droughts or, you know, when fertilized, they couldn't find fertilizer. So it's definitely done before. And even in India, currently we do use cow dung and buffalo dung because, you know, they're very rich in nitrogen and other elements which crops require. So I don't think using your own poop for growing food would be that out of strange of a thought.
Well, yeah, it's space, so you do with what you have on your hands or poop, probably.
Yeah.
So let's moving on. Like, if you think space colonization is possible, which would be the first place to colonize, actually? Taking consideration, like, ISS is already stationed in space right now. Mm-hmm. So we have colonized space up to an extent. But if you consider... Yeah, if you consider a celestial body like Mars or Moon or some asteroids, what would be your take on that?
I'm no expert on this, but as far as I've read about these things, one of the major challenges that is a hindrance to space colonization is the effects of microgravity on humans. And what we've observed so far is that there are several things happening to our astronauts while they are in space. The number one being their bone density is severely impacted because of the microgravity. Your bones require a constant force of gravity to keep them healthy. So when you remove gravity from the equation, they tend to lose their density. And also, there is a considerable amount of muscle atrophy. And to combat that, astronauts have to exercise. I mean, they have to perform heavy exercising for at least 3 to 4 hours every day to just maintain the muscle tone. And even then, over a period of 6 to 8 months, they are losing some of their muscle definition and some of their muscles are getting atrophied. So microgravity is a bitch, if you pardon my language. But and because of that, colonizing in space stations is not very practical unless you have artificial gravity. And so that is another bag of, kittens, if you talk about, because currently we don't have technology to simulate gravity. The closest we can come to is centrifugal force. So if you have a space station, probably the shape of a ring or something, and you rotate that, you could somehow simulate gravity. But then again, the Coriolis effect comes into play. And the Coriolis effect is such that, just think of it like this, that if you're in this huge ring, which is still tiny, that ring is no way the size of Earth, right? So even if it's like 20, 40, 50 meters, you cannot build beyond a physical limit, because then the forces acting on the station would, tend to break it. But what would happen is, the centrifugal force would be acting on your feet and your head in a different way. So basically, if you just divided your human body into different levels, your different levels of your human body would be affected by the centrifugal forces in a different way, and that would make you dizzy. So space colonization in long term in a space station is not feasible, and which is why we should be looking at celestial bodies with at least a gravitational field of their own. And currently, I think the best candidate we have is Moon, because we've already done that once, we as a human race. And I think we can do that again.
Yeah, that sounds good. So Moon would be a good prototype, or like a demonstration test.
Yeah, like a proof of technology, or like a technology demonstration mission. But people often, I told you, Shankly, if you invite me to this podcast, I'm just going to keep on talking. So I hope you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. That is why I have called you.
People often, when people ask that why haven't we gone back to the moon, we as in the American or like Russians tried, they couldn't, but whatever. Why haven't humans gone back to the moon? And often we get an answer like we've already done that, and then there's no motivation for doing that further. And I can think of two distinct motivations. The first is mining, where moon is like really rich in helium-3, which can be used for nuclear fusion. It's a good source of fuel. It's used for many things on Earth, and it's quite rare. But on moon, it's found in abundant quantities, and it could be mined profitably. And the second one is, moon does not have an atmosphere. So it's good and bad. It's bad because you don't get shielding from the radiation, which you get from the sun. But it's good because if you want to launch anything into the orbit, you don't need heavy chemical boosters, or you don't need heavy chemical rockets. You can just launch things into the orbit using a railgun. You can use your moon as a forward operating base for colonizing the rest of the solar system.
So do you think that's possible?
Probably a century later, you have to have a forward operating base, right? If you have to launch, so I read this article somewhere. I think you can fact check this if you want. But currently, if you want to launch something into low Earth orbit, it costs somewhere around $22,000. And if you want to, launch something into geostationary orbit, it costs somewhere around $80,000 per kilogram, if I'm not wrong. And overall, if you want to launch an interplanetary or a planetary or an interplanetary space colonization mission, is going to be very difficult if you're going to launch everything from Earth because of the gravity well. So you need somewhere which has less gravity and no resistance from the atmosphere, so that you can economically keep on launching your crafts. You can obviously assemble them in orbit, but not having an atmosphere and having a lower gravity helps. So yeah, I think we can, have it as a forward operating base.
So like what a gravity catapult that usually most of the sci-fi movies have shown. It's easier to catapult from moon than from Earth.
Yeah, definitely. Because, again, no atmosphere. You don't have to worry about other things.
Nice. So basic necessity for any colonization would be like food, clothing, shelter and communication. So food, like I explained, like a human poop. Food, do you think it's possible on moon though?
On moon, yeah. Several orbiters have actually identified presence of water on Moon near the poles or near the craters, there are certain craters which are so deep or so near the poles that because of Moon's tilt, sunlight has never reached there. But with infrared imaging, we've found, and we as in not me, but like,
we found
the presence of water in the form of ice on Moon. So that is a huge positive because, well, water is everything, right? Right from growing crops to humans to even like, you know, even for generating power, having water is, I mean, as long as you have sunlight and water, you can effectively create hydrogen and oxygen out of it. So it doubles as your life support system and it doubles as a power source. Yeah. And I forgot your question. What was your question?
It was about food.
Definitely. Yeah. So I think we can definitely grow food because the amount of sunlight that Moon receives is almost equivalent to that which Earth receives. So we have sunlight covered. We have water. We just need to probably, I'm not sure about the regolith on Moon, but regolith on Mars is poisonous a little bit. I'm not sure about regolith on Moon, but you could somehow create a growth medium and grow crops on Moon for, you know, for food.
That's a good plan. So if you start agriculture on Moon, then it's possible. So if we colonize Mars next, then you can just take the crops from Moon and then ship it to Mars.
You don't need to ship crops. I think you can just ship seeds. If you've kept up with the recent developments in cannabis, you would know that you don't really require soil to grow plants. You can just grow them using aquaponics or hydroponics, or, you know, you just need a growth medium and chemicals. Yeah. Your plants can't tell the difference between soil and chemicals. So basically, plants require three chemicals primarily, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And as long as you're giving them that with sunlight and water, they basically can't tell the difference. They're happy. So, you know, you can just grow them in water, or you can grow, or, you know, so there's this like a very interesting experiment that they're carrying out in International Space Station where they're growing these plants in mesh nets. So the growth medium is not soil, but just like a net where they keep on misting water and the plants are happy. So you can do that.
Yeah, I've read that article as well. And I was also shocked to see that if you grow anything, like let's take, for example, a pumpkin in space with no gravity or like microgravity, it is highly possible that the pumpkin will keep on growing because there's no resistance, no atmospheric pressure that's acting on it. It will keep on growing as much as possible. So it's never ending process. You can just chop it off and eat it.
I mean, if you look at farms on Earth, I mean, like even in India or even outside India, pests are a huge hindrance to crop growth. I mean, if you remember, just a few months ago, we had like a locust swarm, you know, in India, and it had ravaged through fields and destroyed crores of rupees worth of food. But that's not an issue if you're growing it in a controlled environment where nothing else grows, because then you can just isolate those plants and just give them the exact amount of nutrients they need, and suddenly you have very happy plants which are giving you really big, healthy fruits.
Yeah, it's a good produce then.
Yeah, definitely.
That's a good thing. Apart from food, like, what do you think about clothing? There's solar radiations that we have to overcome. So do you think, like, anyone that will colonize there will always have to keep on wearing the suit?
Definitely. And I'm pretty sure even while wearing the suit, you're not really shielded per se. I mean, I don't really have the numbers, but cosmic radiation from the sun is quite dangerous. So even during the International Space Station, if there is going to be an electromagnetic storm on the sun, all the astronauts are advised to close all the hatches of the space station and stay within the stations. And they are shielded by, so basically there are these water tanks on the boundaries of the lining the space station. And water acts as a shielding medium or like, you know, some layers thick aluminium which lines the, so basically suits are not enough of a shielding. And that's going to be a major problem on Moon as well as Mars, because none of them have atmospheres, and none of them have magnetic fields of their own or strong magnetic fields of their own to, you know, to reflect or deflect these cosmic rays. So that's going to, you know, that can cause you cancer on the long run. I mean, and you don't want that. So probably in the first few hundred years until we are that technologically advanced, I think we'd have to build underground shelters or at least line our shelters with at least 4 to 5 inches of regolith.
That's a good idea to make a colonization that's underground for a period of time when we are technologically advanced enough to make like a space city that has a dome which you usually see in all sci-fi movies.
Yeah, but instead of it being glass, you just build it. It's made out of soil. Yeah. And like a few inches, a few meters deep soil. Mm. Actually, Andy Weir, the author of Martian, has discussed this in great detail in his another book, which is called Artemis. And he's discussed this problem in great detail. So if you ever get a chance, read that book. That guy knows how to write hard science fiction. So, yeah.
Nice. I'll check that on. So the shelter is all done. Like, what about communication? Like, Earth will be a base station, basically. So if you're on Moon, you're on space, you're on Mars, you're on any other planet, you obviously have to communicate with the base station that's on Earth. There will always be a communication lag. And I think when you're colonizing a separate space entity, communication will be very key. So if you have no knowledge about what the problem is or how to solve it, how do you think you can tackle that?
I mean, currently the communication lag between Earth and Moon is just 1 second. But the farther you go away from Earth's orbit, that becomes slightly tricky because the communication latency, the communication gap between Earth's and Moon is somewhere between 22 minutes to 45 minutes, depending on the relative distances between Earth and the Moon. And also during certain times in the year, Earth and Mars cannot see each other because the sun is between them. So in those cases, I think for a period of 20 days or something, there's going to be a total communication blackout. So when you're sending, colonists to the Moon, it's fine. You can, you know, you can support them whenever they want to. But when you're sending out a mission to Mars, you have to be certain that they're able to take critical key decisions on their own without any help from Earth.
I have also read this somewhere, like you require just 41 people to repopulate the whole humanity, basically. So do you think that will work if we are colonizing Mars? So we sent 41 people on Mars and they can repopulate, or like, will there be effects during pregnancies or complications, something like that?
So I think 41 people, I don't know whether you're talking 41 males, 41 females, or just 41 people in general. But
in general,
But I think 41 people is too less of a number, because eventually there's going to be a lot of inbreeding, because 41 people is very little genetic material. You need genetic diversity for a healthy population. Because if you don't have genetic diversity, there are going to be lots of recessive traits which then become dominant and they get expressed, and you know, you'd have lots of genetic defects showing up in the babies as they're born. Additionally, I think you can look it up, but I checked somewhere that 1,000 people, 500 women and 500 men are enough to, I would say, repopulate or you know, multiply and have a healthy population. 1,000 people would give you a huge amount of genetic diversity instead of 40.
Yeah, I agree. This was somewhere, I think I read it, so the sources are not that accurate. Or
I mean, it has been observed. I mean, there are certain populations which have had considerable amount of inbreeding. And those populations, you can see the babies or the younglings obviously always express these genetic defects. So, yeah, the more amount of people you have, the more amount of genetic diversity. You don't even have to have more people. You can just, I mean, we are at a fantastic time in science currently where we can just freeze sperm and freeze eggs, and we are getting pretty good at IVF, which is in vitro fertilization. So as long as you're freezing eggs, cryogenically freezing eggs and sperm, you don't need people, you just need surrogates.
Yeah, that's true actually. Also, do you think like, okay, when someone is like pregnant in space, so the radiation and everything with that much exposure, do you think they will be immune to that after certain years or something? Mm-hmm. Or they'll still require, as a human organism, they still require shielding even after they are born?
I'm no expert on this, but I feel that somehow somehow Martian gravity and Moon's gravity should be all right for fetal development as long as you're shielding them from the radiation. But having babies or like fetal development, again, I'm not a doctor, but fetal development in microgravity or space seems a little bit sketchy to me, because again, I talked about how microgravity has effects on bone development. So obviously bones are not going to be as strong as what they would have been if the baby would be growing under gravitational influence.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain studies which state that if a baby is born on Mars, the baby would not be able to sustain themselves back on Earth. So, yeah, that is a serious detriment to, I would say, human growth. I mean, once a baby is born on Mars, if they come to Earth, they're going to have serious troubles. I mean, Earth gravity is going to be too much for Martian babies.
So it will probably literally crush them by their bones.
Not really, but I think it can definitely, because, okay, it might not crush their bones, because human bones are stronger than that and they take compressive forces pretty well. But it could have a serious effect on the cardiovascular system, because right now on Earth, right now when you and me are talking, our hearts are busy pumping under Earth gravity, and no matter how tall you are, like even if you're 6 feet tall or 5 feet tall, your heart is pumping blood throughout your body. Because it is used to Earth's gravity, the muscles of your heart are developed for that sort of work. But if your heart has never experienced Earth's gravity, if it's just used to Martian gravity, it's not going to be able to pump. I mean, it's going to be able to pump well in Martian gravity, but you take Martian gravity out of the equation and add Earth's gravity, things are about, I mean, you're going to put a lot of stress on the cardiovascular system. It's not going to be able to pump the blood as efficiently as it would have in the gravity it was used to. So that is one challenge that I think we need to tackle, and I think it's at least 200, 300 years until we are able to tackle that.
That's quite a long time.
I think by the time we are 60, we should be seeing colonization.
So like the first step for colonization.
Yeah, definitely.
Elon Musk is planning a lot on that. I've also heard him say like, let's nuke Mars. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, nuking Mars is it's not that good of an idea, but you could obviously redirect asteroids. So if I'm not wrong, JAXA, which is Japanese Space Agency, was successful. So JAXA has had their space probe, which is called Hayabusa, and they were able to basically land on an asteroid, if I'm not wrong. So we have the technology to basically land on asteroids. So just we need to scale that up, and once we have the ability to redirect asteroids, all you have to do is capture a big enough asteroid which has a lot of water in it, and most of asteroids have a lot of water in them. Because of that, they tend to, because of this very reason, comets sometimes display tails, and tails are basically just water vapor getting heated and getting blown out of the asteroid. So basically, if you are able to redirect a water-rich or an ice-rich asteroid towards the surface of the Mars, it's going to impact, and that's going to add a lot of heat and energy to the system, and that's going to slowly and steadily because I don't know if I mentioned this before, but when we talk about ice in terms of space, it's not just water, but it's also ammonia, it's also methane. And ammonia and methane are like greenhouse gases. So something we don't need on Earth, but something we desperately need on Mars because we need to capture the heat.
So it will be a good source of fuel as well. Methane is good for cooking
definitely,
as well.
So instead of nuking Mars, if we could redirect asteroids at Mars and keep on bombarding it, that would be a low cost and a non-destructive approach towards colonizing Mars, I guess.
Yeah, plus also you won't have to wait for the radiation to dissipate due to nuclears.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
That's really good. What, like for the communication, I was thinking, what if we put a lot of satellites in between Mars and Earth so it can act as relay?
So, but then again, we are limited by the speed of light. So even if you put thousands of satellites, or even if you were able to hypothetically put a LAN cable between Mars and Earth, the electrical impulses are still going to be, you know, flowing or getting transmitted at the speed of light. So even if you had a hard connection, it's still going to take the same amount of time. So communication gap is inevitable unless you are somehow able to devise a faster than light mode of communication. So until then, you are just bound by relativistic speeds.
So bound by physics back again?
Yeah, exactly. Physics is a bitch.
What about logistics? So if someone is like, let's take for example, hypothetically you have 10 people who are the first 10 people to colonize Mars. And they reach Mars and they start the colonization with the small shuttle, small cabin, whatever they require to grow and live there. So what extra things do you think that they require? Do you think it will be something like Europeans in the Crusaders' time decided, okay, there should be like a skilled labor that knows this thing completely. There's another doctor who will take part, look into the medical of the civilization. Then there will be some other expert. Do you think it will be wise to send all the different field of experts to colonize Mars initially? Or would it be like, okay, 10 random people who are good at survival basically? So they can survive anywhere. So the survivability is high. So you should send like 10 people who have high survivability or 10 skilled people in their own fields.
I think you need to send people who are experts in their own fields because, I mean, again, this is something that they talked a lot about in The Martian, and which is also quite practical. I mean, when you're sending people to Mars, they need to be, you know, jack of all trades essentially, and master of all trades, because the next resupply or the next spare parts or the next repair station is, you know, millions of kilometers away. So there's no way you can get repairs or, you know, spares in time. So when you're sending out, talking about logistics, when you're sending out these people out to colonize different celestial bodies, the farther you send them away, the more risk that they're taking, and you have to outfit them in a certain way. So you have to make sure that they have ample amounts of spares. There is a huge amount of interchangeability, which is, again, a huge factor and also a very big part of engineering. So interchangeability is something which needs to be there, because you might have to remove things from, you know, something and then attach it or repurpose it for something else. You need to make sure that all the attachments, all the hoses are compatible with everything else. So that is, I think, one very big, big concern when it comes to sending out space missions. And that's going to be a very big challenge. So while you're designing all your components, right from your habitation module to your farming module to your, you know, life sustenance module or whatever you call it, right from power to everything, everything needs to be able to adapt with everything else. And everything should be able to function on its own if required.
Yeah, that's true. That's correct. Okay, another question, like it's completely unethical. But hypothetically, like if actually it takes about 8 months, 8 to 9 months for any anything new from Earth to reach Mars, right?
Right, right.
So hypothetically, if there was like 10 people on Mars, and they were out of food, or maybe the food was destroyed and they have nothing to eat, do you think cannibalization would be a way to go or not?
Yeah, but cannibalization will not give you that much energy. I mean, a human body is Okay, so, well, okay, this is a very weird topic, but yeah. Human body is again muscle, right?
Mm.
And it's red meat. So, you need to cook. So there's a reason our ancestors cook food, because it makes most of the nutrients available for the body. It makes it easier to digest. And again, it's a very weird territory we're getting into. But I don't think a human body has enough caloric value for you to last 8 months, dude. I mean, and plus it's just protein. You need carbohydrates, and I mean, it's protein and fats, but you need carbs too in order to survive. I mean, it's going to be one hell of a keto diet otherwise. But yeah, I don't think cannibalization is an issue. So you have to make sure that they have lots of spare food. The initial missions would have to, you'd have to give them two or three times the food that they require just to account for, you know, fuck ups like these. But apart from this, I think 2 to 3 years of a backup food source is required. After which I think the colonists would have their own Martian grown food ready. I mean, there are currently experiments going on where, you know, they're trying to grow crops hydroponically. They're trying to, you know, cultivate different algae, which you can consume and which will give you the same kind of sustenance. They're trying to work on lab grown meat. So you don't have to kill animals. You can just basically take muscle cells and clone them and give them growth medium so that you can eat steaks, which are directly made in the lab without killing any animal.
Nice. Plant-based meat, basically.
Yeah, plant-based meat or animal-based meat. Like, what I'm talking about is you just take cells when they're about to divide, and you, and under current and under correct amounts, you know, correct situations, if you give them the same amount of growth nutrients and the electrical stimulation and mechanical exercise so that the muscles develop well, you can actually have this fake meat, which is scientifically molecule by molecule having the same composition as real meat, but isn't made from an animal. I mean, it technically is, because you've taken the cell from the animal, but you haven't had to kill any animal for it. And I think that could be a very big achievement, because animals require a lot of water and food for growing, so it's not going to be very sustainable if you are, you know, raising livestock on Mars. So lab grown meat is the way to go when it comes to, you know, Martian, or when it comes to space colonization.
So pretty much using the best scientific methods to make the survivability as good as possible, or in the best case, in keeping it as best case scenario as possible.
That's definitely.
Good take. So just considering, okay, we have spoken about like space, that's ISS, and then like Moon and Mars. If we take it a bit further, let's take Titan. If there's possibility of colonization in Titan, that's pretty far away from Sun. There's barely any sunlight there. Do you think like the survivability would be very difficult? Because we have a lot of hydrogen cells available, so you can generate electricity. And just using electricity, you can run a lot of new things and produce new things. So, do you think that survivability is possible that far away from Sun?
It is. I mean, technically, it shouldn't be a problem. And again, technically, it's like technically with like quotes. But it takes 8 months just to go to Mars. I'm pretty certain it took Voyager at least 5-6 years to reach Jupiter. That amount of time is going to cause serious issues to humans while they're en route to their destination. And we've never explored Titan and Titan in Europa and all these, you know, moons per se in detail. So we don't know what they have. We think that they might be habitable. We think that there might be liquid water or, you know, liquid methane, ammonia or anything on there, but we don't know for sure. So unless and until we are actually exploring them by sending landers and landing probes, we cannot be sure. But Mars is a safe bet. And even more of a safe bet is Venus. In fact, I am surprised nobody's talking about Venus.
Oh, that's a good point.
I mean, think about it like this, okay?
Mm.
I mean, for the non-technical people listening to this, you might want to look up something called the inverse square law. But for the technical people, inverse square law is a bitch, right?
Mm.
So the amount of solar radiation which is reaching Earth, I think a quarter of that or half of that is reaching Mars. So basically, you're going to require twice the amount of solar panels if you want to get the same amount of energy, right? But it's the opposite case when it comes to Venus, because Venus is much closer to the sun. So you're getting twice the amount of radiation over there. So you can technically do with lesser amount of solar panels. Again, secondly, the gravity on Mars is, if I'm not wrong, one third of that on Earth, whereas the gravity on Venus is probably the same. The only problem is that the atmospheric pressure is about 900 times more than that on Earth. So there's a little bit of a problem there.
Okay, that's a big problem.
Okay, also one more little problem, which is that there are clouds of sulfuric acid on Venus. So you don't want to be breathing that air. But here's the good thing, right? If you've seen Star Wars, there are cloud cities. There are cities entirely based in the clouds. And you can have that. You can have these huge blimps which just float around on the surface of Venus. And because of good availability of solar radiation, you get energy. And the best part about Venus is that Earth air is less denser than Venus air, which means you don't need hydrogen or helium or any other expensive gases to keep your blimp afloat or to keep your station afloat. You can just pump your station full of Earth air and it's going to float because it's much less denser.
Yeah.
And it's much more closer. So Mars is farther away, but Venus is much more closer to Earth. So Venus is much more of a viable option than Mars. Also, one very important thing is that the air pressure, right? So there's near vacuum on Mars. It's hardly 1% of Earth's atmosphere, which is still nothing. But if you, I think, come to a certain altitude on Venus, the air pressure is exactly similar to that of Earth. So you don't have to wear a spacesuit to keep your insides from boiling. You just have to wear something which will be able to resist the acid. And a really good thing about that is the firefighting equipment that we have nowadays, right, which our firefighters wear, is both acid resistant. The firefighting equipment is resistant to corrosives and can also sustain these hot temperatures up to 500 to 600 degrees Celsius. So those are two ticks in your favor if you want to colonize Venus. And I'm really surprised why there aren't more people talking about Venus, because, I mean, why not?
Like you said, basically, like, you'll have a floating blimp on Venus. So it technically is not living on Venus. It's basically floating above Venus.
Yeah, I mean, you could always, you know, tether yourself to the surface by sending down anchors if you wanted to. Humans... And again, I've read this in some book, probably Carl Sagan, probably Neil deGrasse Tyson, I'm not sure. But one of these authors that talked about, I'm pretty sure it was Carl Sagan, that humans, because of our evolutionary history, have a very weird way of thinking about colonization. We always believe that until we plant that flag on the surface of the planet, we haven't really colonized it. And that is a wrong way to go about it. Because even though we haven't planted a flag on the surface of Venus, we are still in its sphere of influence. And I think that is, I mean, I think we've pretty much colonized it if we are growing plants in it, if we have to go,
become Martian. The counter would basically be like, you're colonizing a place, so you're basically colonizing a land. But when you are unable to step on that land and survive there, it wouldn't technically mean colonization.
Correct. So, and since you're floating, you are not tethered to one exact geographical position. So in case of Mars or the moon, you know, this territory is yours, right? And
yeah.
when it's on Venus, you know that that blimp is yours, but nothing else is yours. You're just going to be floating around in the atmosphere. And one of, and like it or not, one of the main motivations for space colonization is going to be political. And politics, well, they don't like it if you can't claim something.
Like, exactly. Yeah.
They want to go there if they can claim something for their country, but if they cannot claim something, they're much more reluctant to go there.
The space but, actually says that, like, no country can claim any part of the space other than the land on the Earth.
Yeah, but do you really think that's going to stop anyone? It says the same thing about Antarctica, by the way, but that hasn't stopped people from claiming Antarctica or sections of Antarctica for themselves. Like, countries right from Netherlands to US, Russia, China, everybody's claiming a part of Antarctica. Even though nothing grows there, even though people cannot survive there for long periods of time. It hasn't stopped countries from claiming parts of Antarctica. So I really don't think we are that smart as a species to not claim planets or, you know, parts of planets for our own. I think we are too greedy for that.
Well, it's too big of a deal or too big of a thing to claim. Like, you can claim like a particular section. Okay, maybe like you colonize Mars and this 10,000 or like 500 square kilometer is your own country on this. It's like an embassy there. You own it, but then technically space law would prevent it to own it like permanently. It would be like, okay, you're temporarily in this place. That's why you're able to own it for now. But you have to go out. You have to move out. It's same thing in Antarctica. Like, the people or the countries that have claimed places there are there temporarily. So when the scientists, those are working there, go out, they actually take their whole equipment and the whole shelter and move out. So it's not theirs anymore.
That is true. However, treaties prohibit countries from mining Antarctica. And that, and Antarctica is much more closer than Mars, so I think it's still feasible to go to Antarctica. but you know, as I said, you know, political motivations. Governments are only going to agree to send manned missions to Mars or Venus or Jupiter or anywhere else in the solar system only if they want, if there's something, if you know, if they're going to get some money out of it. And the only way you can get money out of it is mining, because those are untapped resources. You don't know what's in there. There could be hydrogen, helium-3. There could be huge, huge mines of platinum, you know, all heavy elements over there, which are like vastly untapped reserves. And I don't think unless you give them or unless you're permitting the governments to carry out mining, they're going to, there's going to be any motivation for colonizing them. So, that, yeah. And,
even if
and
you
then,
take that
and then when you say, then when you say that there's a 500 kilometer square kilometer area which is reserved for one country, there's again going to be infighting as to, you know, what part of this is mine and who has the rights to resources for this and that, something like that.
Yeah. There'll be different law for the underground. There'll be different law for the above the ground laws, the space laws. Yeah. It will be a lot of conflict if politics gets involved with science. Science requires a lot of freedom in that sense.
Yeah, it requires freedom. And if we are sending out a mission outside the Earth, I think it's best we send it out from humanity and not from individual countries. I think that would be the best. Because if we have to take this big step, which probably makes us an interplanetary species, I think we need to forget about these imaginary borders that we're drawing on the planet. I think that is the way to go forward.
Oh.
If we have to colonize something, you know, outside Earth.
Privatization of space travel will make that happen much more easier compared to having government agencies doing so.
But at the same time, don't you think that if you're getting private companies into this, they're just going to use it for their own benefit? Like, I read it somewhere that some of the first trillionaires you'll be seeing would be because of space mining. So I'm pretty sure like corporate interests have ravaged Earth's ecosystem so far. We're seeing the effects right now due to climate change. You really think there's going to be anything stopping them to do the same outside Earth if there's money to be earned, if there's money to be made? So I don't think privatization is necessarily a good thing unless there is a lot of red tape preventing the exact same thing.
But there's always loopholes to...
Yeah, exactly.
So, but don't you think, like, even if you can mine, like, let's say planets, let's just take the nearest one, Moon, for example, there is abundant of H3 available there. Don't you think the logistics of, like, going there, mining it, and then taking all the components back, and instead just doing fusion here on Earth would be much cheaper?
I didn't follow your question. Like, you think, I mean, you're talking about mining something on Moon or Mars and then sending it back to Earth. No, that would be, I think that would be very expensive. Again, if we have probably, you know, cheaper ways of space propulsion, right now there has been some really good breakthrough when it comes to ion engines, which are able to, so their rate of acceleration is constant. It's very little, but over a period of time, it builds up. If you're using engines like those, you could probably ship huge amounts of material. It would take a lot of time, but they would reach where they have to reach in probably a decade or two decades, but they will reach there, right? But unless we have a really cheap and efficient way of a propulsion system, I think it's not going to be feasible. So when you're mining something on Mars, unless you have a propulsion system, it's going to stay on Mars, or it's feasible for it to be on Mars and to use it on Mars rather than to send it somewhere else.
So what would be the point if you're mining something interplanetary, and then how would you earn a profit from there?
I mean, there are certain materials which their cost per gram is too high. So I think you just have to do a cost analysis, like a cost to benefit ratio. And if it's beneficial to you, you have to do basically a break even point analysis for that. And if you feel like you're going to break even, I think it's a good idea. But I think with our current very inefficient rocket, chemical rockets, it's not a very feasible idea.
You could, like, using some lab equipments, you can probably make your own on Earth itself.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't be very efficient. But also, so Shanky, I think one thing we can do is we can mine planets like Mars or Moon for propellants, right? You can mine propellants from there, and again, exactly what they did in the Martian, and it's not very far off from, it's not fiction. You could, in theory, do that. Again, we know that Martian polar ice caps have ice, and again, ice means helium. Ice means methane and ammonia. And methane is combustible. You can use that for rocket fuel. So if you're able to mine these polar ice caps again in huge quantities to have huge amount of reaction mass to send away these mined products, then you could probably do it. But otherwise, I don't think that's quite feasible.
That's a really good idea. If someone listens to this podcast, I'm pretty sure they would try it. If they do, you can claim some royalties.
I hope Elon Musk is listening. Yeah, you know, a little bit.
let me tweet that to him.
Yeah.
This is how you colonize a planet.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sure. If you're listening, please take me and your team.
That's a good sales pitch right there.
But yeah, I mean, initially there are going to be challenges to this. Many people are going to die doing this. And we can be certain that if we are going there, we have to go there and think of, I mean, it's going to be an entirely new frontier. Think of the times when the European people first colonized, I would say quote unquote colonized the Americas. I mean, there are already people living there, but you know, sure, let's give them that.
It's a fact. You cannot say no to that. It's a fact.
Yeah, I mean, let's give them that. They colonized it. But it's going to be like that. Many people died because they didn't have resources. And if we have to take this next evolutionary step for humanity, you're going to have to do the same thing. There are many people going to be dying. There are many sacrifices which are going to have to be made. Probably the children born on these planets will not be compatible with Earth environment. So, you know, you're sentencing them to always live on Mars under those conditions only. It's going to be difficult but that shouldn't stop us, because we thought flying was difficult and we thought going to space was difficult, and there were times when we thought crossing the seas was difficult. So yeah, if we could do those things, why not this? I think it's the next natural step in human evolution.
Scientific big breakthrough.
Yeah, I guess.
Hmm.
I mean, scientifically, if you think of this, right now we have the technology to do what it takes. So somebody, some crazy guy with enough money can, in theory, design a Mars mission and send people on their way to Mars right now at this minute. But we are not doing that because it's not feasible, because it's not going to make you money. And it's not going to make you money because we don't have very efficient propulsion systems which can carry those ores or, you know, those raw materials or even finished products. So again, this is a very, very important thing. Refining of elements is also a very big thing. So there are going to have to be huge and giant leaps in refining of raw materials for you to actually make space mining a profitable thing, because it's a very stupid idea to ship ore from Mars to Earth and then refining it on Earth. You're going to have to refine those materials on Mars and then you're going to have to send the finished product to Earth or wherever you have to send it to. And for that, again, you need huge leaps in refining technology where you're minimizing the size of the refinery. And again, if you're minimizing something, it becomes inefficient. So the reason, and again, refineries are not very efficient. I know this because I've interned in a refinery while I was doing my bachelor's. So they're not efficient by any means. They require a lot of energy, right? So especially when it comes to fuel, they use this technique called fractional distillation. And what you're doing is you are heating crude oil in a way. Basically, you give it a diverse temperature range and different materials separate from the crude oil at different temperatures, and then you collect it from different trays at different temperature levels, right? But these, if you look at like refineries which are in like HPCL or BPCL, you know, they're huge. Like they are like 12 or 13 story buildings. Like they're quite huge. And they use a lot of fuel to heat the crude oil.
Yeah.
Right. But in order to do that on Moon, you're going to first of all need a lot of fuel. If you have to minimize it, it becomes inefficient, because then you're going to require, you know, it's inefficient because you can only put in a small amount of raw material at a time, but you have to use, you know, you can theoretically, you know, you have to expend energy for that. So unless you, you know, have a breakthrough in refining technology, I think, again, it's not feasible. You can obviously send an exploration mission to Mars, but I think until then, it's not very feasible.
Going on Moon was an exploration mission in a way. So the man stepped on Moon as a part of exploration mission. But for Moon, there were so many robots, like Land Rover and lot of robots that landed on Moon, landed on Mars for exploration, that like currently human exploration to Mars won't be feasible because of the same reason. You can send a robot. There would be no problem with any human losses there. You could still get your data back. That won't be an issue there. So that basically robotics formed a hurdle right there that a man couldn't land on Mars.
Well, if you think about colonization, or like, you know, Neil Armstrong and the Apollo missions landing on the Moon, it was just political flexing, right? So
Cold War,
it was because of the Cold War. They did not do any act. I mean, they did the most they could, but most of it was, they didn't send scientists. I mean, the first few missions was entirely composed of Air Force pilots. So they sent soldiers on the Moon. They did not send scientists, the ones who could have contributed more to the research and development. So I think, again, you know, when it comes to sending people, or like when it comes to colonization, the focus needs to be shifted from politics and from flexing and sending soldiers to a planet. And you need to change that to scientists. You need to change that to researchers. People who are actually, you know, whose field, who've actually spent decades researching a particular topic.
This is like the, I had this conversation with another friend of mine who was basically like, when there's a space agency and you're trying to colonize a place, politics always comes into picture, or military comes into picture, because there's always a possibility that there might be existence of a low form of alien somewhere. And because you're landing into unknown place, as animalistic instinct of animals on this our planet Earth, if there's something new, they'll attack you. So even if you're going on Mars, and if there is some life form there that you don't know about, there's always like, okay, because animal instinct states that they will attack you, they'll always send military first.
Well, military can't do anything about microbes, can they? I mean, I'm pretty sure there aren't any little green men on Mars. Like, so even if there is any form of life on any of the planets in the solar system apart from Earth, be it Europa, be it Titan, be it any other planet, it's much more likely that the life is in form of microscopic, you know, like it's much more likely that we have microscopic life and not macroscopic life. So, and again, military is a very wrong way to go in terms of first contact. Right? If you're going to have first contact, it needs to be, I mean, even if like, you know, let's just assume that there are actually, you know, like little green men on Mars. I don't think sending in soldiers is a very good idea for first contact. You should be making friends with them, not threatening them.
That's again, the thing. Like, you cannot be very safe about it, right?
And again, this is like a huge, I mean, a long shot, because I'm very certain even if there is any life in the solar system, currently it's in the form of microbes. I mean, people, scientists think that there could be life in the oceans of Titan or, you know, in Europa. But pretty certain it's going to be either multicellular small like life or like, you know, single-celled life.
Microbes, so, yeah.
Yeah, and we don't know whether they're going to be carbon-based or silica-based. It's all up to speculation. So carbon is pretty abundant on Earth. And because of that, there's a theory that all life on Earth is carbon-based. But places where silica is abundant, you could have silica-based life. So that life would be atomically on a very different level when you compare that to life on Earth. And we don't know what effects we could have on them, what they could have on us. It's both forward and backward contamination. And actually, because of this very thing, NASA and most other space agencies, even ESA, have their own decontamination protocols. So when they are sending out probes to different planets, they decontaminate the shit out of their probes. They radiate it and everything to make sure that no microbe from Earth is going to contaminate those planets.
Also, like when people are going in space and coming back, the decontamination protocol is also very strict. So
I don't think they do it anymore, but I'm very certain when the astronauts from Apollo missions returned back to Earth, they had to spend a few weeks in isolation just to make sure that they weren't, you know,
contaminated by space microbes or space.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so one of the very alarming reasons for this was moon regolith is very fine. And it's like very, 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 very fine. And it's sharp because there's no vacuum. And I mean, because there is vacuum and there is no wind, this regolith has been sitting on the surface of moons for billions of years and not moving at all. And because of that, it's very sharp. So what had happened was when the Apollo astronauts entered their lander and removed their suits, they inadvertently breathed some of these regolith in. And that caused a little bit of flu-like symptoms. Like it caused a little bit of sneezing and coughing. Because they, you know, breathe minute amounts of this regolith. And this was alarming for NASA at that time because, you know, they really thought that, you know, they might have caught a bug or something. But after a while, they realized that, okay, this is because of the regolith. And after that, these protocols were, you know, loosened a little bit. But before that, they were required to spend some time in isolation. And I'm very sure if there is some human coming back from Titan or Europa, the protocols are going to be much more stricter because scientists actually believe that there's going to be some amount of life underneath the oceans.
So it's always based on speculation, but it's better to be safe than sorry. So
definitely. You don't know how it could affect you. I mean, you don't know whether you could die. It could have no effect on you, or it could have a really bad effect on you. But it's always nice to, you know, err on the side of caution. So.
That's a good thing. So this is all points to basically colonize space or any other celestial body in space.
Yeah, I mean, again, if you think about it, it's the next step, next logical step in evolution, don't you think? I mean, we have colonized the entirety of Earth, right? Humans, again, I'm going to quote Carl Sagan over here, because he's one of my favorite authors of all time. Carl Sagan said that we are explorers at heart, right? He says we were wanderers. And if you think about it, since the prehistoric times, they say that humans originated in the heart of Africa. And the humankind just, you know, dispersed all over the earth from there. We have been, you know, wanderers for a very long period of time until some 20,000-30,000 years ago. Humans started, you know, humans invented agriculture and started to settle down. So after millions of years in human evolution, for the first time ever, we had more food than we could carry. And because of that, we had to, you know, stay down in some places. We had to keep livestock. We had to, you know, think about habitation in a particular place. And since then, we've never, but we are always wanderers at heart. Traveling always excites us. I don't think there's a single person in this world who does not have these fantasies of traveling. So I think that is hardwired into our genome, this traveling bug, as we speak. And right now, we have traveled everything there is to travel on our planet. So I think the next logical step is to move out. I mean, that's what we were meant to do. And I'm pretty certain planetary colonization is not going to be the end of it. Humans, I think, are destined to do great things. I think we should be an interplanetary civilization in probably the next 1,000 years. Interstellar civilization in the next 1,000 years.
Again,
that's a whole new can of worms. It requires faster than light travel, or relativistic travel at least. It requires... you know, technology of states. I think that's another topic of, you know, wo to alag bhi topic hai podcast. Talk about it. Let's just stick to the topic.
Yeah, this was a really good conversation about space colonization altogether. Amazing future. Like, interstellar colonization would be like very, very huge. First, let's take first initial step to colonization to moon and Mars. So it was great for you being on this podcast and talking about this topic you're really curious about.
Yeah, I had fun. Thanks for this, dude.
Thank you too for coming on this show. Thank you for listening, guys. Thank you guys for listening. This was episode 4 of Curiously Chaotic. Please tune in next week for the next episode, where we might be talking about aliens and extraterrestrial creatures.